It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
There are other news cycles, you know, besides what you see on cable TV. The tech news cycle, for one, the trade news cycle as well. We are here for you on those. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, the 24th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, there was an interesting little something in Facebook's earnings announcement after the closing bell today. Yes, they made tons of money. And yes, they've got almost 2.5 billion monthly active users. Also, though, the company disclosed it's the subject of an antitrust investigation by the Federal Trade Commission. Now, those closely attuned to the tech industry and the regulation thereof will note that the Department of Justice announced yesterday it is investigating big online companies as well for antitrust, although it did not mention Facebook by name. We got to say that. So you roll that in with the $5 billion fine that Facebook just got hit with and hearings galore over the past couple of years. Might we be at a tech regulation tipping point? And if so, what might that mean for how Facebook et al. Do business? To help us figure that out, we've got Molly Wood, the host of Marketplace Tech, on the phone. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
All right. Well, what do we think? Might things be getting real if I can continue with that construction?
I, to play along with this construction, I think that things are getting real. I think the United States has been, you know, a bit behind the curve, but it does seem like regulators and lawmakers have worked actually pretty quickly, despite, I think, what we have talked about, some high-profile embarrassments with respect to hearings, have, in fact, worked pretty fast to get up to speed. And I think that, you know, once you have the Department of Justice involved, even if it's sort of announcing investigations that at this point are very broad, if it's showing up in Facebook's earning reports, it's getting serious. And I don't think that this is the last we're going to see on this topic by a long shot.
What are they going to be looking for? I mean, you know, antitrust and big companies, big tech companies specifically, right? You get Microsoft, AT&T. It's got a long and drawn out history. How are we going to know?
It does. And, you know, when people sort of lump in the big five or the big four, at least at minimum, tech companies, Amazon, Apple, Facebook, Google, you know, these are really different companies, of course, that do different things. So when it comes to trying to investigate and apply an antitrust filter, you know, in some ways, the existing antitrust law is going to fit like a glove. If you can look at, for example, anti-competitive behavior that leads to higher prices and harms consumers, then you could easily look at Apple's practices and say, okay, look, the App Store is the perfect example of that. Or Amazon, you know, drives up prices because its pricing algorithms are invisible. That seems pretty clear. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, but Facebook, I mean, you know, come on, man. I just click on and see pictures of my friend's kids or whatever.
Facebook less so, right? It's going to be harder to prove the harm. There's not a pricing aspect necessarily. And so it's possible that what we might also see, and this is a parallel effort at the FTC right now, is a look at those existing regulations and whether they do need to be applied in a different way, because honestly, even Apple and Amazon aren't pure monopolies in terms of market share. So, you know, I think it's going to there. It could require some adjustment of antitrust law. So it's going to be a long process.
OK, allow me to insert my maximally cynical comment here and ask you a question. I know I've asked you before when we've gotten to Facebook and tech companies and regulation. Is anything, do you think, going to change in how these companies do business?
I mean, that I know that's your favorite question, and I know that's always fundamentally is the question. I think so. And that doesn't mean that that change is going to be dramatic. It doesn't mean it's going to be soon. But at a minimum, you have increasing global regulatory awareness of these companies' behavior. So you've got Europe acting strongly. You have the U.S. actually taking some action, even if it, you know, if you read the FTC's complaint privacy order with respect to Facebook, it sounds like something Facebook wrote. That is true.
Right.
But that is still a change, even from 2 years ago, and a change from 2 years before that, when any old app could access anybody's information from Facebook, right? So I think we will see incremental change. It may not be as much as some people want. It may be more than other people want. And sometimes that middle ground is actually right where you want to land.
All right. Super quick at the end here. We head into the 2020 campaign. Washington will be preoccupied. But Elizabeth Warren and others have made the big tech companies a campaign issue. Do you think we get bogged down, or do things happen behind the scenes and progress is made?
I think things are going to keep happening behind the scenes. I really do. I think it's going to be hard to put this genie back in the bottle. And on both sides, there is agreement that things cannot just be business as usual going forward.
Molly Wood, the host of Marketplace Tech, and with me, a podcast we do together, where, by the way, we've talked about some of this stuff. It's called Make Me Smart. Thank you, Molly. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Kai.
All right. Bye-bye. I am obliged to note here, by the way, that Facebook shareholders don't care a whit about regulation. Shares up sharply in after-hours trading. More broadly, things were kind of mixed. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We say all the time on this program, because it is true, that this is a global economy. And we have also been pointing out of late that while the headline numbers here are good, the rest of the planet is slowing down a bit, which gets us to Caterpillar, the big equipment company, and its profit report this morning. Lousy is the short answer, because it's dealing with rising costs, tariffs in part, and slowing demand, China specifically. And as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports, Caterpillar is not the only company facing those two problems.
This is not just the story of one company.
Oh, no, it's not just Caterpillar.
Rob Wertheimer is a partner at Melius Research.
I mean, so across the industrial economy, we've seen inventories rise to uncomfortably high levels.
That means there's a lot of unsold stuff at global manufacturers. David Dollars with the Brookings Institution.
The slowdown in China is probably the main thing that's happening.
People in China are not buying as much of that stuff. Mary Lovely is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute.
Both companies that produce in the United States and export to China, or those American companies who produce in China for sales to China, both types will be hurt by the slowdown.
Think automakers or tech companies like Apple, but the slowdown could also touch services like package delivery or finance. And this is not just in the U.S.
We're seeing a slowdown in Europe. In particularly, Germany is seeing great weakness in its manufacturing exports. We're seeing a slowdown in South Korea and Singapore.
China's slowdown is independent from the trade conflict with the U.S. Derek Scissors is with the American Enterprise Institute.
China's economy is slowing because of Chinese decisions that go back years.
The trade conflict is hurting certain U.S. businesses that buy parts from China. And some companies are getting hit on both ends. They both buy from and sell to China. Exhibit A, Caterpillar, which had to pay $70 million in tariffs last quarter. Peterson's Mary Lovely says, for now, the effects of the Chinese slowdown, the trade conflict, they're isolated. Emphasis on for now.
It will translate to the rest of the economy over time.
It may not be enough to tip the U.S. into recession, but it's enough to cause some pain. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Over to immigration now, the legal kind. There are a bunch of ways that people can get green cards to this economy. Lawful permanent residency is the legal vernacular. Investing is one of those ways, but as of this morning, the size of that investment is going up. A rule from the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services published today in the Federal Register says that under what's known as the EB-5 visa program, people who want to invest their way to a green card are going to have to spend at least $900,000, up from $500,000, and invest that money in economically distressed areas. Those who want to avoid areas in economic need are going to have to spend almost $2 million to get in the door. Marketplace's Andy Euler explains the price hike.
The idea behind the EB-5 program, created in 1990, was pretty simple. Get rich foreigners to put money into American businesses. That would create jobs, especially in economically distressed areas. In exchange, those investors would eventually get two-year green cards.
It's played out in one sense spectacularly successfully.
Carolyn Lee is chair of the American Immigration Lawyers EB-5 Committee.
But in terms of the other idea of trying to channel a portion of this capital into distressed areas, I think that's been more mixed.
But getting that cash to poor areas is what acting director of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services Ken Cuccinelli says he's hoping to do. He told reporters the new regulation will make sure that the investments are targeted to rural and high unemployment areas. Mitch Wexler is a partner at the Framingham Law Firm in Southern California. He expects his business is going to pick up immediately.
All those potential applicants that are kind of sitting on the fence, either not believing this was going to happen or they weren't sure they were going to go for it, are falling on one side or the other of the fence right now.
He says most of his clients are from India, and there's already a 7 or 8 year wait for an EB-5 visa for people from there. There's a limit to the number of visas that can come from one particular country. China and Vietnam have long lines too. Aaron Grau with Invest in the USA is looking for a complete revamping of the EB-5 program so visa holders can stay in the U.S. permanently without worry. He's concerned these new rules will hinder that.
Lawmakers may look at the regulations and then look at the requests that we're making of them to reform the program statutorily and say, well, let's give the regulations a chance to work.
The new rule goes into effect November 21st. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
We had the CEO of Hearst on the program yesterday talking about, among other things, the decline of and dismal situation that local news is in, Hearst being a big newspaper company. The classic ad-based business model papers have relied on for basically ever, right? They just don't work anymore. But there are some digital news outfits trying to make it with a new model by going hyper-local. From WHYY in Philadelphia, Laura Benchoff reports.
28-year-old Tom Sofield dreamed up what would become his digital news startup back when he was in community college, taking journalism classes.
We started like an online blog for a class, and people started reading it, so it was kind of accidental.
After school, he got a job for a digital news company called Patch, but he held on to the idea of starting something of his own. Sofield grew up in Lower Bucks County, just north of Philadelphia. That's where one of the first planned suburbs, Levittown, is located. These tightly packed communities with cul-de-sacs and cookie-cutter houses turned out to be the perfect place to start a local news website.
I looked at how many local businesses there were. And then I looked at the population, the income, and Levittown seemed to be that sweet spot where there was still a lot of small local businesses.
Those businesses equaled potential advertisers, and the population density, readers. His first site, levittownnow.com, is 6 years old. It averages more than 700,000 page views a month, and while he won't give specifics, Sofield says it's profitable. Even so, he recently reorganized, cutting 2 full-time reporting positions. So while he refers to his business using the word we...
When you say we, there's one person?
Yeah, so right. So me, and so we have a business manager part-time.
And freelance reporters. He says that provides more flexibility. Staying small keeps costs down, but new and old media companies alike are still grappling with how to make money.
So many of these startups are still supported by advertising, and we know that advertising is not a growth area for news.
That's Stephanie Murray, a professor who researches local journalism at Montclair State University. Big tech companies like Google have been gobbling up ad dollars and making billions of dollars a year passing along local news content. So many of the new local digital outlets are looking to diversify their revenue streams through things like events.
These are your drink tickets, all right, and these are your wristbands.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
On a warm, cloudless Saturday, journalist Kevin Tierney is holed up in a bar in Conshohocken, another Philadelphia suburb. He's running a Mexican food-themed bar crawl called Taco Hocken to support his news and opinion site called More Than the Curve. It's named after a nearby bend in the highway. Tierney charged $20 a ticket and convinced a local company to sponsor the event. Attendees get one free drink and cheap tacos. He says in addition to advertising and readership goals, the company is always looking for new ways to leverage its name and local connections.
We have on top of that, obviously, the events like today. We also do merchandise. We do something called town cards.
That offers card carriers discounts at local restaurants and businesses. Taco Hocken participant Patricia Powell is hanging out with friends at a restaurant called Tierra Caliente. She says she looks to More Than the Curve for information about new real estate developments and what's going on with the borough council.
It's fun to read the comments on the different posts and get some local news because it's so local. I don't really know any other way that I would get it.
The dollar tacos are just an added bonus. In Philadelphia, I'm Laura Benchoff for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I discovered soon after starting there that I would have to work more than one job.
The side hustle strikes again. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials finished the session down 79 points, 0.2%, 27,269. The S&P 500 up 0.4%, 14 points, 3,019, a record high, by the by. The NASDAQ up 0.8%, 70 points, 8,321, also a record high. With apologies to Charles Dickens, this earnings season is turning out to be a real tale of two economies. The best of times for Snapchat, the social media platform, announced it added 13 million users over the past quarter. Shares up more than 18%. The worst of times, though, for Tupperware. The company reported the trade war and slowing economies worldwide have been dragging its business down, just a lot like, Caterpillar, as Sabri was telling us. Tupperware finished the day off 19%. The season of light for UPS. The delivery service beat revenue and profit expectations. Shares in United Parcel Service gained 8.6%. Today, a season of darkness, though. For some of the companies that actually operate stock markets, NASDAQ revenues missed expectations. Shares fell 2.6%. Come on, that was genius. You're listening to the Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. As of Monday, according to the Department of the Treasury, the government of the United States is in debt to the tune of $22,669,203,729.33. I told you that so I could tell you this. The House and Senate are set to vote on a budget deal in the next week or so, a budget deal that will increase our indebtedness over the next couple of years, and about which John Harwood of CNBC, also one of our Friday regulars, has some thoughts, the first of which is that the Republican Party somehow keeps losing these budget fights. John, it's good to talk to you again.
Great to be here.
Can we now say, with this budget deal that appears set to pass, that the GOP, the Republican Party, as the party of fiscal restraint, is now officially over and done with?
Yes, although that's been true for some time. They were over and done with when they passed that big tax cut a couple of years ago. What we see is that the Republican Party is publicly committed to spending cuts, but not actually committed to it. They were willing to, for the fourth time, roll back the spending caps that they had imposed on President Obama in 2011, and they have not taken up the issue they say must be dealt with, which is curbing entitlements. President Trump says we're not doing that, and they remain committed to cutting taxes, and that is a formula for the return of trillion-dollar deficits, and that's exactly where we are.
That's where we are. Why, then, does the GOP keep coming up on the political short end, as it were, of these budget fights?
Because what Democrats are defending are services that exist because people want them. People want their Social Security and Medicare benefits. And in the discretionary parts of the budget, the parts that were just the subject of this deal, they want transportation spending. They want NIH and health and scientific research spending. And they also want a safety net for people of modest means. And so you're defending things like low-income housing subsidies and child care subsidies and health care. All these are things that were passed into law because there were was majority support for them. What Republicans do is support spending cuts in theory, but when it comes to actually fighting over taking away services that exist, the public doesn't want that. Republicans know it, and they back away.
We should be clear here that there is a slice of the Republican Party in Congress that calls this deal a train wreck, that it's just horrible.
Right. But the people who describe it as a train wreck take some of the other actions that we're talking about. And I was talking to a Republican strategist the other day who said this is a winning outcome for those members because the spending takes place. It's passed. Their constituents continue to get the services that the government is providing, and they get to portray themselves as the defenders of fiscal responsibility as an argument for reelecting them. So that's a political cake and eat it too type of argument, but it's what some Republicans think about.
There is no small irony here in that it was Republicans who obliged President Obama in 2011 to agree to the Budget Control Act, the sequester, and now with those tax cuts of 2017 that you talked about, have hamstrung their ability to stick to their guns, as it were.
That's right. And remember, this is a consistent pattern over a number of years. Every Republican president since Ronald Reagan has seen the budget deficit increase on his watch. Every Democratic president, and we're talking there about Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, has seen the budget deficit decline. That is being repeated under President Trump. And the question is there going to be, after President Trump, a Republican Party that returns to claim the fiscal responsibility mantle they once talked about pretty consistently, but it's not there right now.
John Harwood of CNBC, and every now and then on a Friday, this program. John, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
It can take time to develop the skills you'll need to get by in this economy. And then it can take even longer to work up the confidence it'll take to set out and try to become your own boss. Today's installment of our series, My Economy, is a reminder that the journey can be worth the effort.
My name is Rachel Whitener, and I am a private chef. I am originally from southern Missouri. I moved to Los Angeles 9 years ago. I had thought about going to culinary school when I moved here, but I thought if I could just find a mentor, someone to teach me, then I would be a couple of steps ahead and with less debt in my bank account. I lucked out and landed in a restaurant in Santa Monica called Wilshire Restaurant. And there was a pastry chef there who interviewed me and set me up for a stage. That's when you do a kind of tryout. You work a shift in the kitchen. And at the end of it, she said, "You are clearly passionate about this and very intentional. And so I think you are the person for the job." I discovered soon after starting there that I would have to work more than one job if I was going to survive in this city. For
reasons I can't remember. I think I was just on the internet looking up gigs and found a posting for a job as a cook for a family. I felt confident enough that my skills were growing that I decided to try to go for this job. I went to work for them, and I ended up staying with them for about 3 years. And I was able to take all of this experience and get another job working as a private chef. I realized that I had finally reached a point in my experience and in my skill where I was finally making a salary that enabled me to work just the one job. And that's when I sort of knew that I was being properly valued. I think a lot of people who work for someone and then decide to break off on their own and be their own boss, everyone goes through this time of feeling afraid of whether it's going to work. But when I began to really own the place that I had come to and how much skill I had and how valuable I was, when I began to own that, then the work started coming in.
Rachel Whitener is a private chef based here in Los Angeles. We would love to hear about your economy and how you are shaping it. There is a place you can do that at marketplace.org. Final note on the way out today. I don't know if you saw that story in the New York Times this weekend. One of their reporters was a food delivery person in Manhattan for 24 hours, wrote a first-person story about it. Anyway, the piece got a lot of traction because, A, the New York Times, but also because, B, it raised once again a not great practice by DoorDash, one of the big gig economy food delivery services, in which when the delivery person got a tip, DoorDash basically used that tip to subsidize the pay the delivery person got and then cut how much the company was paying him or her by the exact amount of the tip, if that makes sense. Anyway, as of today, DoorDash has seen the light. CEO Tony Hsu says, quote, "We're changing our model. The new model will ensure that Dashers' earnings will increase by the exact amount a customer tips on every order," which, this is not a quote, is good. All right, we're going. The Dow off 79 today, 0.2%. The S&P 500 up 0.4%, 14 points. NASDAQ up 0.8%, 70 points. Record highs on those last two. Our media production team includes Sarah Bergere, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.